time for us to begin this morning. We're going to continue our study of history and geography of the Bible. Some of you have gone through this study before. Some of you have gone through this study a number of times. And I think it's a very good study, one that's profitable and helps us to remember things that we need to remember regarding the plan of God to save us. Regarding our study this morning, we're studying about the things that occurred between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, of course, that means it's difficult to turn to a Bible passage and say, let's start here, because we're studying in the intertestamental period. However, there's some things that are very helpful in that study. I want you to begin with me by reviewing some of these maps of the Old Testament history. We know that this map demonstrates the empire during the time of David and Solomon. We know that Solomon controlled all of this area up to the Euphrates River, which was the northern boundary that God had promised unto Abraham in Genesis chapter 15. Now, noting that, we see that the river of Egypt was down here on the south. Now, we've talked about the various inhabitants of this land in times gone by. That's not the purpose of our study this morning, so we'll pass over much of that. But here we see that God had promised time and time and time again, if you worship idols, here's what I'll do to you. Now, I need some passages that we're working on. In what passages did Moses warn the people during the time of the Exodus that if you worship idols, I'll destroy you, I'll take this land from you? Deuteronomy 4, 8, and 28 through 30. Very good. Very good. And, of course, we know that when we come to the days of Isaiah, that was about 750 years before the coming of Christ, that Isaiah prophesied specifically who would be the instrument of God's wrath in conquering them because of their continued worship of idols. I believe you'll find that in Isaiah chapter, is it 10, verse 5, beginning, I believe, where the text identifies the Assyrian Empire. Now, when we look at the next map, we see how the Assyrian Empire has come down into the northern kingdom, and Samaria was taken captive in about 722. Again, depending on what source you're reading, you might read 721 in some sources. But Samaria fell to the Assyrian Empire. You recall how the Assyrian king sent word to King Hezekiah in Jerusalem to surrender. And this map is just fascinating to me because it shows the little bitty empire of Judah compared to the huge Assyrian Empire during the time when the Assyrian king, through Rabshakeh, his captain, threatened the city of Jerusalem and told Hezekiah, you just as well to surrender because none of the gods of all of the other nations have been able to deliver them, and what makes you think that your God can deliver you? Well, Hezekiah was faithful to God. Rabshakeh cried out to the people on the wall of the city of Jerusalem and, very brief paraphrase, said to them, you need to talk to your king before he gets you all killed. And they did not reply that they would surrender, but they expressed faithfulness and trust in God. And here we see the small little area of Judah still remaining because they are continuing to worship God. Now, in Hezekiah's prayer, he prayed that as they continued to serve him, that God would bring the affliction upon the Assyrians that they had threatened. And so he did. We learned that the morning that Sennacherib got up to lead his army to conquer the city of Jerusalem, that 185,000 of his soldiers had been smitten by an angel in the night, and they were dead. And so he went back to Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire, where his two sons killed him. Now, we continue reading in Isaiah chapter 5. And I believe it's there, or Isaiah chapter 10, I'm sorry. I believe it's in about verse, Randy checked me on this. I'm working from memory on that, and that's not too dependable. Isaiah chapter 10, beginning about verse 12, I think. Let me look. Yes, verse 12. Verse 12. God tells the people that because the Assyrian king has had a stout heart and arrogant, and he elaborates on what the Assyrian king has said, that he's going to be destroyed. Now, it was during this time, after King Hezekiah, that we read of other kings in Judah who were not faithful to God, and consequently, God is going to destroy them. And this gets us to the heart of the book of Habakkuk. That's a book that we seldom look at, it seems, and maybe unfamiliar with the content of the book. But Habakkuk has a problem. As he looks at the people of Judah and sees their wickedness, he asks God a question. How long? How long are you going to tolerate this? And God told him, I'm going to answer you, but if I answer you, you won't even believe what I have to say. And what was the solution? What did God say he would do? Jenny? Overthrow them? Yes. Yes. God was going to overthrow them. Who would he use to overthrow the kingdom of Judah? Babylon. All right. He would use Babylon. And why was that such a shock to Habakkuk, the prophet of God? They're worse than we are. And he just didn't understand that. But God told him, I've got a plan for the Babylonians too. And what was that? They're going to be overthrown. That's right. And so we learn then that Habakkuk learned the need sometimes just to be quiet. And so he surrendered that God knew what he was doing. And we know that God raised up the Medes and the Persians, the Medo-Persian Empire. Isaiah chapter 44, the last few verses on into the first couple of verses of chapter 45. God names the name of this man, Cyrus, who would release these people, the people of the Jews, and allow them to return to their homeland and rebuild the temple that existed in Jerusalem. Now, this demonstrates the map, the territory of the Medo-Persian Empire. And you'll notice how large it is, larger than the Assyrians, larger than the Babylonians, as it has consumed a large portion of land. Now, when Cyrus writes the decree, you can read in the beginning of the book of Ezra, of the decree that Cyrus wrote, allowing them to return to their home. This map indicates them returning after that period of Babylonian captivity under that decree of Cyrus, the king of the Medes and the Persians. Now, during this time, yes.
We learn an interesting lesson from the point you just made, is that if an individual or a nation, for that matter, is evil, or if an individual or a nation, for that matter, doesn't even believe in God, that doesn't mean God still, it doesn't mean that God cannot still use that person or that nation for his own purposes.
Well, that's right, and it's an interesting point. It's an interesting point that you raised. When we look back and see Pharaoh, king of Egypt, God overthrew Egypt, just destroyed everything about them. But Pharaoh raised the question, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? Well, we know he found out who God is and that there is one God. However, when we study about Pharaoh, we learn in a number of places in the book of Exodus that Pharaoh hardened his heart and would not allow the people to go. We also note that God hardened Pharaoh's heart and that he would not let the people go. In fact, if we notice in the beginning of that, when God called Moses to go down and speak to Pharaoh, he said, but he will not let you go. So God knew that from the beginning. Well, that raises the question. Here we have a wicked man who has imposed wickedness upon the people of God. But God is going to use this wicked man and show his authority over him. Well, did this wicked man then, because of the providence of God, not have the right to exercise his own choice? Yeah, he could exercise his own choice. You see, simply because God uses a man does not overrule the choice of that man. But God can use the choices that he makes to accomplish his purposes. Case in point, when we come to this period of the return of the children of Israel, under the time of the Persians, we read about Esther and Mordecai, and we read about Haman, who hated Mordecai because he wouldn't bow down and worship Haman. And Haman desired to cause all the Jews to die, so he got the king to write a decree that on a certain day all the Jews would be executed. And the interesting text is in Esther, is it chapter 2, verse 4, or Esther chapter 4, verse 2. You can look that up. It's on the right-hand page, right-hand column, about that far down. But Mordecai said to Esther that it very well may be that God has raised you to this place for this purpose. But notice, if not, he will deliver his people. So the Persian king, who had been persuaded to write such a decree, if that decree had gone forward, it wouldn't have changed things. Let me get Jenny and I'll come right back to you.
Chapter 4, verse 14.
Thank you. Right-hand page, about halfway down. Well, it is my bad. Okay, thank you.
Well, I mean, the corollary to what we're saying here is a point you've made before when we studied Daniel, is that ultimately God rules and continues to men. And there are times when it may not appear on the surface like God's in charge of God ruling, but he is.
Well, that's true, and I think sometimes our problem in studying is we become so isolated and so focused on one thing that we don't see the surrounding events that are transpiring. And that sometimes becomes a hindrance to us. You've heard the expression, we can't see the forest for the trees. And that's exactly right. But what we see is God's overall plan revealed in the Scriptures. And we sometimes become so focused on one particular portion of that that we forget about that God is going to fulfill His plan. Through His providence, it will come to pass. And if that means using the decisions that men make, then He will use those decisions.
Even if they're simple decisions, that God can still use anybody that He wants to bring about as well.
Well, that's right. That's right. And in conjunction with that, if you look in Isaiah chapter 10, when he talks about the king of Assyria, it tells us in verse 5, 6, and 7, Ho Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in whose hand is mine indignation, I will send him against a profane nation and against the people of my wrath. Will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like the mire in the streets. Now look at verse 7. Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither doth his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. Now, the king of Assyria, it was his desire just to conquer. But God used that desire to fulfill his purpose. Now, did that mean the king of Assyria didn't have any right to exercise his choice? Sure he did. But God could choose the foolish or use the tulip. God could choose the foolish choices that this king made to accomplish his purpose. I think I said that right. Yeah, don't ask me to repeat it. Oh boy, it's going to be one of those days. Background of Haggai and Nehemiah. Of course, that fits into this context of the restoration period. We've talked about that when the city of Jerusalem fell, and when the Babylonians fall to the Medes and to the Persians. And we've talked about how that Cyrus issued the decree. We talked about the temple being rebuilt under the leadership of Ezra. Zerubbabel involved some in this, and Haggai writing about it from about 520 to 516 B.C. Then we talked about how that Nehemiah returned in 444 and rebuilt the walls around the city of Jerusalem. I don't want to spend much time on this particular chart, so I'll just pass over that with the click of a button. But when we look in Jeremiah's prophecy, we know that Jeremiah had prophesied concerning the condemnation of Judah. But he did indicate that after 70 years, they would be returned. Now, I don't remember specifically, that's why I wanted to include this in this chart, if we talked about what was necessary for a restoration. Did we discuss that in any length? That's when you say something. You don't know. You don't know, Rebecca. Of course. What's necessary for a restoration of national Israel? Well, we've already studied from Deuteronomy chapter 30 that when you return and keep the commandments and statutes and ordinances of the law, then God will bless you. Now, that's what would be necessary for a restoration. In Nehemiah 13, verse 22, what did they do? Ezra chapter 8, or Nehemiah rather, chapter 8, what was done? The law was read in their hearing during this period of restoration. And they repented of their sins. Now that doesn't mean they didn't commit more, but they repented of their sins. So now we've got a restoration. The Levitical priesthood, when Nehemiah helped them in this period of restoration, one of the things that he did was to restore the priesthood. Ezra participated in that. But how was the priesthood to be restored?
Well, those that went into captivity had to go knowing who they were, and so that they could identify themselves later on as being a tribe of Aaron.
Well, that's right. Now, when Nehemiah brought some back or led them in this restoration process, in the restoring of the priesthood, it was done according to the genealogies. You can't just appoint any man as a priest. So the genealogies had to be read. And we see that in this text as well.
That means that some of those people taken into Babylonian captivity, even though they may have believed in God, they were taken anyways.
That's true.
The nation as a whole was evil.
That's true.
Daniel being an example of being a good person, but still taken and
yes.
Still suffering.
Yes. And even though Daniel exalted to a position or elevated to a position in the palace, you've got Ezekiel over here, who was a good man, taken captive. He was among the what we would call the regular captives. So yes, you've got numerous examples of that. Excellent point. Just being a good fellow or a worshiper of God did not excuse you from consequences brought on by the national activity of the leaders of Judah. And of course, then in the rebuilding of the temple, it was significant that they restored temple worship during this period with the Levitical priesthood, and all was good. Now, when we come to the other side of this chart, what does it tell us about ever being under the law of Moses again? What does the New Testament tell us? Never. We will never be under that law again. In fact, in Galatians chapter 2, and particularly Galatians chapter 5, the writer said that we are free from that. So why would we be brought back under bondage to that law? We'll never be under the law of Moses again. And regarding the priesthood, what about the Levitical priesthood? Will it ever be established again? There are all kinds of reasons for that. Number one,
well, I mean, the Hebrew writer makes it clear that's the one of the main purposes of the book of Hebrews is to convince them you wouldn't want to go back to that law, and here's why: because it's inferior. And he lists all the reasons that it's inferior compared to the new law. So why want to go back to it?
Well, that's right. That's right. In Hebrews chapter 8, we have that on the board, beginning about verse 1, the writer identifies that the very chief point is this, that we have a new high priest. And then in chapter 8, verse 4, he identifies that Jesus could not be high priest on earth because there were those, according to the law, that were designated to be priests on the earth. Well, what does that tell us about his priesthood? Not earthly.
This is kind of an aside, but it's the same place we are historically. In the intertestamental period, well, specifically, specifically after Rome had taken over. Didn't they appoint the high priest? Didn't
yes.
the Roman government appoint
yes.
the high priest?
Yes. Yes. And so you've got a real difficult period of time. I think we talked about that some on this intertestamental period when we were studying Daniel and the Ptolemies and so forth and their work and service, yes. And during the Maccabean revolt, we'll talk about that more then. We see how the temple was desecrated and so forth.
Even the high priest they had at the time of Christ wasn't right.
Not necessarily, no. We may talk some more about that when we get to that. This idea of genealogies, what does the New Testament tell us about the Old Testament genealogies? Well, very plainly, Paul said to both Titus and Timothy, neither give heed to endless genealogies which minister questions and strife. So, of what tribe you are from, as far as a Jew is concerned, doesn't make any difference. And furthermore, why can no Jew today know what his genealogy is? Can't track it. And why can't you track it? The records were destroyed. Yes, in 70 AD when Titus, the Roman general, destroyed the city of Jerusalem.
And Jesus prophesied that.
Yes, he did.
Not only in Matthew 24, but as he was being led to the cross.
Yes. Yes. Very good. Very. I don't recall that, but that's very good. Now, what about temple worship? Temple worship involved the sacrifice of animals. What does the New Testament say about that? Will that ever be again? No, never be again. In Hebrews chapter 10, beginning in verse 1, we learn that it's impossible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sin. And why? That's right. That didn't clear their conscience because it wasn't the animal that sinned. It was man that sinned. And so killing the animal didn't suffice. In John chapter 4, beginning in verse 20 through the next several verses, you'll remember the context of John chapter 4. Who's Jesus talking to? John chapter 4. Who's he talking to? The Samaritan woman. Yes. And of course, we've already discussed in that context how that the Samaritan woman wants to pick a fight because Jesus is a Jew and she's a Samaritan and he's talking to her. And then Jesus said something about living water and she thinks he's talking about Jacob's well and takes that as an insult and wants to fight some more. But Jesus ignores both of those attempts to create a difficulty and talks with her about salvation, talks with her about worship, and points out that the time will come when neither in this mount nor in Jerusalem will you worship God, but those that worship God will be worshiping in spirit and in truth. It's not the place, it's the how. Joey?
I think one could almost make the argument that if the records, the genealogy of the records, were still relevant, God would have kept them from being destroyed.
Well, yeah.
The fact that he allowed them to, I don't know that we can say, well, God caused them to be destroyed in person. I don't know that we can say that. But we can say that God would have prevented them from being destroyed if that information was going to continue to be relevant. But I think that's the very point, is that those genealogy records are no longer relevant because of the change of law.
Well, that's right. An interesting note just there. When we talk about the providence of God, it's very difficult to point your finger at this incident and this incident and this incident and say, that's the providence of God, without the text telling you that it is.
Yeah, because you can say, well, did God cause that, or did he simply allow it?
Yeah.
And these are often difficult or impossible.
But when you look at all of these, the law of Moses, the Levitical priesthood, the genealogies, the temple worship, it was all contingent upon this. All of it was contingent upon the law of Moses, and if we're never going to be under the law of Moses again, then what inevitably has happened to all of these? Gone. It's gone. Now, the means by which that happened, we say, well, God brought that about. Well, yeah. And we can talk about providence there, but what we do need to see is that God could use all kinds of choices of men to bring that about.
Well, in the big picture, it's all the providence of God that all that happened. As Jesus said, that I did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it.
Yes.
He came because of that. That's what led up to him.
Yes.
And the reason we don't need any of that anymore is because of it.
That's right. Yes, he removed it all.
He set us free.
Set us free, yeah. Now, I want us to look at this chart because it brings us up in a timely fashion to the Grecian Empire. The Grecian Empire was large, and we've talked about that, but I want to look at this portion right here. Sometimes when we are talking of this period of time, we get a little confused. I know I do. When I talk about the Syrian Empire and the Assyrian Empire, they're not the same. In fact, separated by vast amounts of time. The Syrian Empire. This period existed during this intertestamental period when the king of Syria desired to stamp out temple worship. And so this is where we are when we talk about the Grecian empires. And so we want to look at that just a little bit. This illustrates the travels of Alexander the Great, and I'll just quickly pass over that as he expands his kingdom. Now, interestingly enough, after Alexander's death, this land changed hands five times. Now, we've said our maps stay the same. We're still talking about the same geographic, as far as topography is concerned, it looks the same. But who owns it varies, and the border lines vary. And when you have a change of kings, often border lines vary. And so we want to see that after Alexander's death, things began to fall apart. And some of this was the influence of the Samaritans, and we've talked some about that. But what I want us to see just here is how some of this began to take place. And you see up here to the north, Syria. Doesn't appear all that big on this map, does it? It appears to be nothing more than a province of what we later know to be Rome during the days of Christ. And that's what it is, or what it became. But when you go back, look at how big it was. But now, how did it get to be so small during the days of Christ under the reign of the Roman emperors? That's a fascinating story too. And that's what we want to talk about in our study this morning. We've talked about changes in the land and the people. We've talked about the language significance. We've talked about the Septuagint, how that this language significance gave a completed Old Testament revelation translated from the Hebrew and Aramaic into the Greek language, which was a product of the Alexandrian Empire. So now we've got folks throughout the empire that for the most part speak and understand the Greek language. Now why was that so important? What about the Jews, wherever they live? We know that Jews were dispersed in a lot of places. But wherever they lived, they were familiar with the Greek language. So it would enable them to be able to read the Old Testament scriptures. But what about those who were Greeks who were interested in studying this history? You see, they could read the language as well and learn of the history of these people and learn about who God is. No, we didn't talk about this last time, but I do want to get it before you. During this time, we've got the existence now of some new names. We read about Judah, the southern kingdom in the land of Canaan, and Israel as the northern portion of the land of Canaan. But Judah, during this time, becomes known as Judea. Now, you read Judea in the New Testament quite a lot. You read of Judah in the Old Testament quite a lot. You read of the Edomites in the Old Testament. And during this period of change, the Edomites are referred to as the Idumeans. Now, why is that important? When you look at the study of the Herods, some say, well, Herod was a Jew. And let me just back up and tell you why this argument is of great importance to us. When we study from Matthew chapter 14 and Mark chapter 6, and we talk about Herod, Herodias, and Philip. Somebody relate to me the story of that. Herod, Herodias, and Philip. Joey, tell me about it. What had Herod done? He had married somebody.
Oh, yes.
He had.
Yes.
Who did he marry? Herodias. Yeah. And what was the problem with that?
He wasn't entitled to have her as his wife.
All right, and why? All right, to Philip. Yeah, that's the relationship. Now, what was the relationship between Philip and Herod? Well, they were brothers. Yeah. Now, what did Herod do when John said, it's not lawful for you to have Herodias because she is your brother Philip's wife? All right, he put him in prison. That's right. And Herodias, the pleasant, likable woman that she was, demanded that he offer the head of John the Baptist on a platter, which that was what was done. But to get back to the storyline that I want you to remember is when John told Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother Philip's wife. There are those who make the argument that what was wrong with that is incest, and incest was condemned under the law of Moses. Well, now that would be just fine if Herod was a Jew. But Herod was not a Jew. Herod was an Edomite descendant known as an Idumean. He was not under Jewish law. Now, he might have adopted some things of the Jewish law, but the Jewish law specifically was not given to the descendants of Edom. They were given to the descendants of Abraham. Now, when you hear that law and say, well, it was incest because it was a violation of the law of Moses, you want to know, well, who did the law of Moses apply to? It didn't apply to Herod, but God's law governing marriage did. And so an appropriate response, I believe, to that is, if it was wrong to have your brother Philip's wife, would it be right for him to have your wife? Pardon me? Oh, that was Herod Agrippa the First, I believe. I don't think we come along to Herod Agrippa the Second until Paul's arrest and his defense then in Acts chapter 26. The first. Yeah. All right. New names. Old cities rebuilt and renamed. Joey?
Well, the point that you're making here plays also with the argument that everybody's under law.
Yes.
If Herod was not under Jewish law, he was under some law.
Yes.
And otherwise, that would be inconsistent with the scripture that teaches that all of sin fall short of the glory of God. So, like you pointed out before, and it plays right into this point, everybody's under the law of God at every point in man's history. It may be that different cultures were under different laws, but you're still under, ultimately, the law of God.
Well, that's right. And of course, if we go back and study about Abraham and Sarah, we know that Abraham lied about who Sarah was. And Abimelech was very upset about that because he or some of the people over whom he ruled may have taken Sarah to be their wife when she already had a husband, Abraham. Now, we can make the argument that she was his half-sister and all that. It has no relevance to this point. She was Abraham's wife. Abimelech was under law. Whose law was he under? He was under God's law. And he knew that if he took another man's wife, or anyone else did, then they could become the object of God's wrath. And you remember the same point being made with Isaac and Rebekah. To, if memory serves me correctly, another man king named Abimelech. Well, what does that tell us? These kings knew that they were under God's law as it related to the marriage relationship before there was any such thing as a law of Moses, before there was any such thing as a nation of Israel. Does that then surprise us when we read in Matthew 19 and the question is asked, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for any cause? Jesus did not go back to the law of Moses. He went back to the beginning. These two characters, Abimelech, understood that. All right. Now, be that as it may, difficulty in maintaining Jewish individuality. We noted that they were forbidden to intermarry among the heathen nations, Ezra chapter 9 and 10, and Nehemiah chapter 13. An interesting point on this is in Ezra chapter 9 and 10, when the law was read in their hearing, and they learned that they had practiced a lot of things that they should not have practiced, including intermarriage with the heathen nations. What were they to do about it? Put them away. Well, was that easy to do? How long had they been married to these women? Don't say a long time. I heard that coming. Pardon me? All right, they had children by them that were old enough to speak and did not know the Hebrew language. They spoke the language of Ashdod, Nehemiah chapter 13 tells us. Now, in these intermarriages, let's look at this next point. The Jews had been scattered. We know that the captivity had occurred, but not all the Jews who had become scattered throughout the Mesopotamian area under the decree of Cyrus really wanted to go home. Why? Well, that was their home. They had been there for a long, long time, and they had established themselves. Some of them had become very prosperous, and so they had no desire to go back to the land of Canaan. And this next point, during the Egyptian domination, many Jews migrated to Egypt. Now, when Syria gained control, many Jews migrated to Syria and consequently accepted the Greek or Hellenistic culture. Carolyn, this gets back to the question I believe you asked Wednesday night about the relationship of the Grecian or Hellenistic Jews. Was it Jews who adopted Greek culture, or was it Greeks that adopted Jewish law? And I believe that it was Jews that had accepted Greek culture to try to answer that. They came from places of Greek origin. And so they, for all practical purposes, were Greek as far as their culture and practice was concerned. Now the term Gentile, well, that's a new term for us. We find that the term Gentile or Greek came to mean anyone who was non-Jewish. Now, you'll find the term Gentile in the Old Testament, but you find it used specifically in the New Testament relative to an exclusive class of people that were also to be included in the preaching of the gospel. And we find them identified as Greeks. So when we look at the term Greeks and Gentiles, we want to see the same people that are identified by these terms. Religious changes took place in the land. From indifference, we talked about Malachi, how that they offered the lame, the sick, and the blind, and Malachi rebuked them for it, to what I have on the board as perfect obedience. They stand up so straight, they make laws where God didn't make any. And the classic illustration of that, I suppose, is Matthew chapter 15, beginning in verse 1, where the Jews rebuked Jesus' disciples because they didn't eat with unwashed, or they didn't eat, something like that. They ate without washing their hands. it's going to be a long day. They ate without washing their hands. And Jesus used to illustrate their inconsistency what? You violate the law of God. Why? All right, specifically, how?
Because the law says to honor your father and your mother, but you say if you give your money that you withheld your parents to the temple, then that's fine.
All right, so you disobey the law. You elevate your tradition. And so here's religious changes. The pendulum swings. And I think that's significant for us to see that and to see why. Now, this developed a collection of rules regulating conduct to the very smallest detail. Now, we offered as an illustration of that in our study on Wednesday night how that they were not to work on the Sabbath day. Remember that? That was one of the laws given in the law of Moses. They were to do no labor on the Sabbath day. Now, in the giving of the Ten Commandments, we don't find there what that meant. It just says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. But as we read and continue to study, we find that there were a number of elements involved in keeping the Sabbath day holy. One thing was, they were not to travel over a certain distance. If they traveled over that distance, it was considered labor on the Sabbath day. And consequently, some, if they had a journey to make, they would journey so far and then camp there during the night. And then on the Sabbath day, they would go the allowed distance so they would not violate the Sabbath day. They were not to gather sticks for a fire on a Sabbath day. And of course, we read about a man who did, went out and gathered sticks on the Sabbath day, and what was done to him?
Stoned to death.
Stoned to death. That's right. Now, the Jews, in order to keep from knowing that, they didn't want to have a fire on the Sabbath day, so what did they do? They swung the pendulum so far they wouldn't open a door and fan a candle lest they be lighting a fire on the Sabbath day. Well, now the Bible didn't say anything about that, but that was their laws. And they became so amplified in the minds of the leaders of the Jews, particularly the Pharisees, that they bound these things upon the people.
My understanding of those laws is that they started out as commentaries by rabbis.
Probably.
Over the course of the 400 years where there were no prophets.
Probably.
These smart guys that everybody looked up to for advice and wisdom, they would write their words down. Course of 400 years, they had quite a stack.
They did.
Things that had been written down, and they treated it as if it was the law of God.
That's right. And by the time we come into New Testament times, we use these terms, Talmud and Midrash, to talk about the writing of the traditions of the Jews. And this is the source of them. But let me ask a question that I believe is important. And that is, when we look at the teachings of man, do we not generally find that to be true? Martin Luther, for example, who was responsible for many reforms in the Roman Catholic Church, nonetheless said, "Do not call yourselves after men." But he wrote a whole lot. And his followers did not want to depart from his teachings, so they wrote a whole lot. And what did they call themselves?
Lutherans.
Called themselves Lutherans. Now, that's just traditionally what happens. When men write a lot of things, and we've got to be careful of that, brethren, today. Let me underscore that. You know, we may have a favorite preacher, and he writes a whole bunch of stuff, and so we want to align ourselves with him because he can't be wrong. Now, that's just foolishness. Sometimes we need to lay aside some of the material that we read and pick up God's book and read what's in it. Joey?
Nothing new about this.
No.
The New Testament, some say I'm of Paul, some say I'm of Apollos. So even back in the church's infancy, you have people that, if you will, claim allegiance to a man, and the scriptures are making the point there, you shouldn't do that. But our allegiance should be to Christ only and never to a man.
That's right. That's right. Now, among these specific changes, we've talked about the development of the Pharisees. The Sadducees played a very important role in the beginning of the New Testament. The Sadducees, as you recall, did not believe in the resurrection. But they asked questions about the resurrection. The Pharisees and the Sadducees are mentioned many times in the New Testament. The Essenes. Sadducees were considered the Pharisees too strict. The Essenes considered them too liberal. And so they were known for their very strict discipline and isolation from others who did not observe their way of life. Now, we would call somebody like that a radical, wouldn't we? They couldn't fit with the Sadducees or the Pharisees. It is believed that they collected the Dead Sea Scrolls that were found in the north end of the Dead Sea. That some of you, along with me, we went to see those. And that was quite fascinating down in L.A. The Zealot thought that God would come to their aid militarily and usher in a messianic kingdom in Jerusalem. Now, notice this next point. They thought it was treason to pay tribute to the Roman emperor since God was Israel's king. Now, would that get you in trouble? Yes, that would get you in trouble. And so, they became a military party that ultimately led to some of the events that resulted in the destruction of Jerusalem. There were many other religious sects among the Jews. These are the ones generally that we refer to. But strangely enough, most of them looked at the text of Isaiah 2 when Isaiah prophesied concerning the coming of the Lord's kingdom in the latter days and how that all nations would flow into it and that the word would go forth from Jerusalem, viewed that somewhat as a independent, glorious, earthly kingdom, not unlike many today. And that's what they were looking for. Of course, when Jesus came, he didn't come to be that kind of a king. And they crucified him. They rejected him. Randy?
I was just going to say, one of the apostles was called a zealot, Simon the Zealot.
Yes.
In Matthew 10:4. Now, there's a marginal reference next to the word zealot that says Canaanite.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if that means he was a member of that sect or if there's just another word for being Canaan. Canaan is kind of a general term anyway.
Yes, oh yes, that is true.
It's like Palestine.
Yeah, that is true. I'd have to look at that. I've not thought of that. If we consider that as, how do I want to say that? If that is simply the geographic location and not representing someone's philosophy, then that takes on a whole new meaning. But if it's representing someone's philosophy, we note that there were those who became very prominent leaders among God's people who came from some rather strange backgrounds. For example, when you think of Matthew, what was he? A tax collector, hated by the Jews. When you think of the Apostle Paul, he was a Pharisee. Yes, a Pharisee. So this division existed there among the Jews. But then when he became a Christian, the Christians became very skeptical of Paul. And then the Jews viewed him as a traitor. So there's all kinds of lessons to be seen there. But now here's our map of the great Syrian Empire that leads up to the things we want to talk about. Antiochus Epiphanes. You remember that name? Where did we study about Antiochus Epiphanes? In Daniel. Yes, we talked about that in Daniel. And in the book of Daniel, what was it that Daniel was saying about this man? What would he do? Daniel chapter 11. Beginning in verse 21. What would he do? Yes. All right. In verse 20 it says, "Then shall stand up in his place one that shall cause an exactor to pass through the glory of the kingdom, and within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle, and in this place shall stand up a contemptible person to whom they had not given the honor of the kingdom. But he shall come in time of security and shall obtain the kingdom by flatteries." Now we'll have to talk about Antiochus and his significance in this intertestamental period because he is a character that Daniel is making reference to. Okay? Yes. By the way, these need to be passed out. Richard, if you don't mind. These are the review of the lesson preceding the Grecian Empire. And we want to talk about those probably next time. So if you would, please fill those out. And we'll begin.